Right. It's lovely to see folks here. Welcome to the library on Kirkcudbright Book Week, and in fact, World Book Day. What could be a better day to be in the library? It's very nice to see some familiar faces. For those of you I don't know, I'm Alan. And for those of you who do know me as Mr. McClure, I'm still Alan. That's fine for this evening, okay? And I have been asked to come and read you some bits from a couple of books I've read. I've written. That'd be less interesting if it was just books I'd read. And some of you know this one already, because I think some of you heard it in class when you were much, much weer. So this will be a wee trip down memory lane for a couple of you. But none of you will have read this one, probably, maybe possibly not. This is the sequel, which was actually partly requested by folks like yourselves who liked the first one. So my plan for the evening is to read you four chapters altogether, so you are warned. It's going to take that long. Two from this and two from this. And then if you have any questions or about any aspect of it, or if you're interested in what it's like getting a book out or anything like that, then I'm more than happy to answer those questions and we'll see how we go from there. Okay, but I just wanted to say a wee thing in praise of books, first of all. Books, it's really hard to be a writer now because you're competing with Netflix and video games and social media, and there's never been as many amazing distractions for folk of your age as there are now. So if you want a book to stand out in that, you really maybe sometimes have to do some convincing that reading a book is a worthwhile thing to do. And I feel slightly hypocritical trying to convince you because my reading habits are terrible these days. I used to read avidly, sit down and just zoom through a book. But partly over lockdown, my habits changed. Also, I'm getting quite old, so my eyesight is not quite what it was. So I have to put specs on before I can read, and that's annoying. But I still have total faith in the incredible power that a book can have. It is a piece of magic. It's black marks on a white page, and that gives you a journey into whatever has been in the author's mind, but more importantly, it's your personal journey through what's been in the author's mind. No two people read a book the same way. And in fact, if you read a book today and then read it again in 5 years, it'll be a different book for you then, because you've changed and the way you see the world has changed. It's a really, really special contract between a writer and a reader. And if you watch a movie, movies are awesome, I love them, but if you look at the credits at the end, there will have been hundreds of people involved in making that movie. So all those different people, all their ideas have gone into it, and that's very cool. But with a book, it's one-to-one. There will have been an editor maybe and a publisher, but it's an amazing little relationship you can have with someone, maybe someone you've never met, but a little moment that you spend in the time of someone else's imagination, and it spurs you on to have your own imagination. So I warmly recommend reading to all of you, and I also recommend writing to all of you if you feel so inclined. And I know some of you are excellent writers already because I've read some of your things. So shall I just crack on and stop blethering and read you some story? Right, I thought I'd start with the first chapter of this. It seems like a logical place to begin. And apologies for those of you who have heard it before and can remember it. Maybe it'll be nice to hear it again. Who knows? So, Callum on the Mountain came out in 2019, I think. And it's what we might call a magical realist book. So I wanted the world in it to be quite believable, even though there are unbelievable magical things happening in that world. And at the beginning, our hero Callum doesn't know anything that's about to happen. It's all just a very boring wee town that he lives in on the west coast of Scotland. So we'll see how it all starts off, shall we? So this chapter is called School. Here's a scene, look. 12-year-old Callum Maxwell, bored and distracted, gazing from his treehouse at the wee town below. A light breeze is making the leaves rustle round him, and now and again the peely-wally sunlight breaks through the clouds. It almost makes the town look pretty, but our Callum, he's in no mood to notice. Every detail makes him cross. An old car puttering up Main Street from the harbour. Ach! The dog barking in Mr. McKendrick's garden. Yawn! Not even funny when Mr. McKendrick yells, "Shut it, you!" And the dog barks all the more frantically. Well, maybe a wee bit funny. Three sparrows fighting in the leaves below him. A furious flurry of brown feathers and attitude. "Oh, geez, peace," mutters Callum, a phrase he's learned from his papa and likes to roll out from time to time. No, there's no inspiration in this scene, nothing to light a fire in the mind of a young genius like our hero. The town, he decides, is a painful disappointment and everyone in it bears the blame. Don't they know they have a superbrain in their midst? Can't they make some effort to be interesting? How, reflects Callum bitterly, am I supposed to be brilliant in a place like this? Nobody ever thinks that in Kirkcudbright because it's such a fascinating and happening place, obviously. There's nothing for it, they need taught a lesson. Motivated for the first time this morning, Callum snaps a long green twig from the branch above him and carefully pinches off the leaves. "I'm sorry it's come to this," he mutters, "but you've only yourselves to blame." In Callum's clever fingers, the twig becomes a terrifying weapon, a gun of awesome power, fueled only by the frazzling channels of energy which Callum imagines buzzing through his immense brain. "All I need to do is point, aim, and fire. Then you'll all be sorry." By this point, you'll have decided that Callum is a boy with a fertile imagination, perhaps, to be polite, just a touch on the Glaikit side. And to be fair, Callum would be the first to admit this. If caught in an act of silly make-believe, he's quick to laugh at himself. Quick to include you in the fun. He's a good lad, and he knows, of course, he's not really a genius, not really possessed of incredible powers. So you can imagine his surprise when, on aiming the gun at the empty school, narrowing his eyes purposefully and pushing his ginger fringe back from his eyes, pulling his imaginary trigger, he is immediately walloped backwards by the force of an immense explosion. He batters into the back wall of the treehouse, knocking clean through it, and crashes through the branches to the grass below. Constellations of stars dance and fizz in his eyes, and in his ears is a shrieking, ringing cacophony. Then rubble starts to fall, wee chunks at first, falling like spring rain. Then great lumps of concrete and asphalt cannonballing down, and Callum has to scrabble to the trunk of the tree to avoid being brained. Coughing and spluttering in the gathering dust cloud, Callum's back to his senses enough to hear car alarms howling and voices raised in fury and surprise. There's already the banshee wail of fire engines. Oh, and if Mr. McKendrick's dog was excited before, it's pure demented now. Well now, poor Callum's like jelly. He struggles to his feet. He can't quite keep up with what's just happened. Looking dumbly around at the wreckage, he notices he's still clutching the wee green twig. "Well," he says out loud, "that worked a lot better than I was expecting." Then a great black cloud descends on his senses and he's tapsle-teary face first in the grass. He passes out too quickly to notice that up in the shaking branches of the hazel tree, a quick green figure is grinning down at him. It raises its arms, grasps a branch, and swings itself up into nothingness, leaving only the certain fizz of mischief and the uncomfortable fact that mysterious things are afoot. And whispering through the empty air, a breath, a hiss with glee, "See you later, Callum Maxwell," and a vanishing cackle from a time and place unknown for now to our hero. And that's chapter one. And I thought, if I'm going to write a book that might be interesting to read, making a school explode in the first chapter is probably quite a good idea. I hope you're all on board with that. Nobody was hurt, no one's hurt. Actually, it turns out that not only is nobody hurt in the explosion, but every individual bit of the school, every brick, every window, has flown away from the site and then landed completely unharmed. So nothing is damaged, really. It's just scattered over a wide area. And so when the builders come to repair it, they can just put it back together like a big Lego thing. But there is a big hole in the ground, and around the hole, written in Gaelic, is the phrase, "Hello, stranger," which, it turns out, is a message to Callum and his friends from these mysterious beasts, like this green thing that was in the tree. And so he discovers that the whole of Skerrels, the village where he lives, which I think is sort of on the west coast, but there's a lot of Galloway geography going on in there too, it sits at the base of a mountain, the mountain of the story, but there's these mysterious kind of nature spirits that live there too, that nobody can see unless they choose to show themselves to them. And once you've seen them, you can't tell anyone who hasn't seen them. So you might try, but you won't be able to. It'll come out gibberish. So there's these weird things, things of green, who's kind of like a spirit of plants, trees and forests and things. Things of blood, who is like all the animals and the other living creatures. Things of stone, who personifies the mountains and the rocks, and then things of water, who is a personification of rivers and seas and things. So these four creatures start to interfere with Callum's life, kidnap his friends, turn into monsters and swallow them, and it's all quite terrifying and scary for a wee while. I don't know if I should stop for questions after each chapter, or just blaze on through and then chat at the end. What do you think, folks? blaze on through, chat at the end. Yes, yes, Harry, you think so? Good man. Right, that's fine. So, where was I? Callum has a guide, though, because it turns out that Callum's papa, you know, he learnt the phrase, gie's peace for his papa. Callum's papa has known these creatures all his life, and he's never been able to tell Callum about them because Callum hadn't seen them. But now that Callum has seen them, does meet them, he can talk to his grandpa about them. And so a lot of the time of the book is him chatting to his old grandpa who's known these creatures for a long time. I'm going to jump ahead a wee bit for the second extract from Callum and the Mountain. Do shout at me if you've got anything to ask, by the way. Feel free. It's okay. But at this point in the book, a few chapters on, not only Callum, but his three best friends, Vicky, Craig and Stephen, have all met these creatures. So they all know that they're there, but they don't really know much else about them. They've been taken to this weird kind of other world where these beings are huge and powerful, but they seem to have ended up back at home in almost like a normal situation, that they've been having a sleepover at Callum's house, and they're not exactly sure what's going on. So this is the first point at which they start to try and figure out what these weird beings might mean for them. So we have Craig, Stephen, Vicky, and Callum himself. And this chapter is called Dog. Mr. McKendrick's dog, in fact. We're going to meet it again. Right, Dog. So, the sun rises merrily on another glorious summer day in Skerrells, and Callum, Vicky, Craig and Stephen can't wait to get out and about. They head indoors and find their clothes waiting for them in neat piles in Callum's room, as if they've just enjoyed a normal sleepover. Grinning, they get dressed in double quick time and charge downstairs to the kitchen to eat. They have an overwhelming sense of things waiting to happen. Huge, enormous, momentous things. As they sit around the breakfast table, they're itching to discuss their recent adventures, each one of them desperate to jabber at length about the strange and terrifying things of stone, the gloriously devilish things of green, the weird, timeless land which they command as solemn giants, and the bizarre adventures which they feel sure will now await them. The trouble is, though, that in Callum's house, it's customary to sit together at the table for meals, so the four friends are impatiently munching their cornflakes in the company of Callum's mum and dad. This means that, try as they might, they cannot say a single word about their discoveries. Every time, it either comes out as pointless nonsense like, I wish they'd make a film about dinosaurs with helicopters, or else it's complete gibberish like, Pluffuffle Borgle Borglorium Plop. This is making for an odd conversation. What were you four up to yesterday? We hardly saw you all day, asks Callum's dad. We were digging a tunnel to China, answers Callum, which absolutely, with no idea why he said such a silly thing. Oddly, his dad doesn't seem too bothered. Oh yes, how far did you get? Magluflum smagleedle bagleedle baglum, answers Stephen confidently before clapping his hands over his mouth in astonishment. That's nice, says Callum's mum. So what's the plan for today then? We're going to Gullum 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 McGlinty 57 tennis rackets, explains Vicky before muttering quietly to herself, where the blinking flip did the 57 tennis rackets come from? As you can imagine, this quickly becomes tiresome, and so the four friends excuse themselves and head out the front door. Well, that was just plain weird, says Craig, shaking his head. What was that all about? It's things of green, explains Callum. You can't talk about him to people who haven't seen him. It's the reason Papa couldn't tell me about these creatures before yesterday. I suppose that makes sense, says Stephen thoughtfully. Otherwise, everyone would know about them, wouldn't they? They are making for the path up to the monument because Vicky wants to retrieve her cello and Craig wants his phone. That makes sense if you've read the other chapters. And the gate is coming into view when suddenly the conversation stops abruptly. All four of them have simultaneously become aware of something very weird, although none of them can quite put their finger on it. Vicky looks at Stephen. Stephen looks at Craig. Craig looks at Callum. Callum looks at... And then they realise what it is that's bothering them. It's the fact that although they can each see each other perfectly well and recognise one another as usual, and they can't see anyone there who isn't one of them, there are now, quite clearly, five of them. Says Callum helpfully, are you all seeing this? All four of his companions nod. And does anyone have any sort of explanation at all? Four heads shake in his direction. Callum, giving up, has a wee seat on the grass and scratches his head. Right, he mutters. You're Vicky, he says, pointing at her. True, replies Vicky. You're Stephen. I am. You're Craig. That's me. So you're, says Callum, and you'd think that would have sorted things out, but the fourth person he looks at is just so blasted familiar, and actually could be Vicky or Craig or Stephen or indeed Callum himself, that he can't think of a way to identify it as anyone else. The figure looks at him in a friendly way, while the other three all look at it. It's definitely a child. Well, sort of definitely. Well, actually, no, not at all. It's far too old to be a child. And it's definitely not one of the gang of friends, except that, well, it actually sort of definitely is one of them. In fact, it's all of them. And even while he's looking at it, Callum finds his gaze sort of slipping off it and returning to Vicky or to Stephen or Craig, so he's never exactly certain whether there's anyone else there at all, but for the fact that there very obviously is. Suddenly, Craig lets out a cry of understanding. "You're things of blood," he yells, and the figure gives a low bow, then stands, grinning at them. "We are," it replies. And before their disbelieving eyes, it becomes each one of them in turn. Then Papa, then Max, then an oyster catcher, then a seal, an eagle, a worm, a salmon, and finally a kind of buxom, seething mixture of the lot. It does this without really seeming to change, as if all these creatures are part of it all at once, and the four friends have to turn away to stop from feeling giddy. "Oh, stop it, please," shouts Vicky, and as soon as she does so, Things of Blood appears as a sort of human about their size, slender and strong, and wearing a cloak made of fur. He's as solid and unchanging as anyone, which is almost as unsettling as his earlier performance. "You see," mutters Stephen, "this is exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. I mean, if everyone could talk about this guy, if everyone could see him..." "Everyone can see us, human," says Things of Blood. His voice is oddly soothing, warm and rich, and the four children feel their fears melting easily away. "Everyone sees us all the time. It's not seeing, but noticing that is the problem. Watch." Things of Blood points down the path, and the children see Mr. McKendrick striding towards them, shoulders hunched, his yappy wee dog bouncing and skipping along behind him. Mr. McKendrick's dog is a terrier, and a dopily friendly wee beast. It loves leaping up to get clapped, and its tail is always pointing delightedly at the sky and usually wagging fit to shake the glaikit wee beast off its feet. All the children like the dog. Most folk in the town like it, even if it is a bit on the noisy side. Indeed, the only person in the town who seems to really dislike the dog is Mr. McKendrick himself, who spends quite a lot of time red in the face and furious as he bellows at the dog to be quiet. His bellowing is much more unpleasant than the dog's barking, but there are few folk in Skerrels with the nerve to tell him as much. As you can imagine then, the children are not that delighted to see him approaching, especially as they can already hear him hollering, "Shut it, you stupid dog!" at his bouncy wee companion. "Yap, yap, yap," replies the dog, happily. As they approach, Things of Blood takes an easy step into their path, does an odd little pirouette, winks at the children, and becomes impossible to see again. Mr. McKendrick is now right on the spot where Things of Blood was standing, completely ignoring the four children, much to their relief, and bawling spittily at his dog. "See if you didn't shut it, you stupid wee ratbag, I'm going to chuck you off the cliff!"
"Yap, yap, yap,"
replies the dog.
"Shut it!
Yap, yap, yap.
Shut it!"
Mr. McKendrick's voice is hoarse now, and the children can see the veins throbbing in his sweaty red forehead. Their attention is quickly diverted, however, by the dog's next reply.
"My dear fellow, I'm so terribly sorry," it says politely.
Callum's jaw drops, and as he watches, the dog stands up on its hind legs and walks over to Mr. McKendrick. It puts a soothing paw on his hip.
"There, there now," it says. "Don't fret so. I'm just so awfully excited to be on a walk with you, my dear, dear master."
Callum and his friends collapse in laughter at this ridiculous spectacle, but Mr. McKendrick appears not to have noticed anything unusual.
"What are you kids laughing at?" he grumbles.
"Oh, don't mind them, my dear fellow," says the dog sweetly. "Laughter is a wonderful thing, is it not? And they are but young. Oh, the sweet foolishness of youth."
And bizarrely, never once acknowledging that his dog is talking to him, Mr. McKendrick seems to calm down a bit.
"Aye, well," he says gruffly, "just watch yourselves."
The dog gives a big approving grin. Wonderful, it says in delight. Now, if I'm not much mistaken, I believe we were off on our peregrinations, were we not, oh beautiful master? And off they go. I suppose we shouldn't be that surprised, says Vicky, after they have recovered from their helpless laughter. After all, the whole blinking school exploded, and everyone more or less forgot about that in a couple of days. Kind of makes you wonder what else goes on under folks' noses, says Callan. And they carry on to fetch the cello and the phone, nodding friendly hellos to all the rocks, trees, shrubs and creatures they pass along the way. And that's the end of that chapter. So, as the story progresses and the things of green and things of blood and the others continue to interfere in Callum's life and his friends' lives, he gets more and more agitated about what it is they actually want. What do they want with him? Why have they got to know him? And it turns out that they really want to be believed in. So part of the theme of this story is that nowadays it's often thought that there's a bit of a disconnection between us and our natural world, the natural surroundings. I think it's less true in places like this because we've got easy access to the sea and the river and trees and things like that. But if you grow up in a city, you can feel very divorced from the natural world. And in this book, Things of Green and the others obviously feel this. They feel that they're kind of losing humanity a bit and they want their attention, but they're not very good at getting it in a sensible way because they're a bit nuts. They're kind of crazy, like nature is. But eventually it turns out that they themselves believe that the mountain is kind of an entity, and they almost worship the mountain. And there's a terrible worry that if the children don't start to follow Things of Green and the others, then the mountain itself will eventually disappear and leave Skerrels, take the spirit away with it from Skerrels. I'm not going to tell you how that ends, folks, because that's the ending of the book, and that would be a massive spoiler, and I obviously want you all to read it. You can borrow it, by the way, from this very library, free of charge, and I recommend that you do. But I wanted to jump on a bit, since you chaps are a wee bit older than most of you, a little bit over 12, I'm guessing. I finished that book a while ago and never thought of writing a sequel. I had no plans to do it. I thought it stood alone, and I still think it stands alone quite well. But lockdown came along. I was kind of looking for things to do. I was taking a break from teaching, which is my main job, as some of you know. A few folk had asked about what happens. What happens to Callum and the others? What goes on? What happens after that book finishes? So I kind of dipped back into the world of Skerrels a couple of years later. So in this book, Callum is 14. And I do have to give away a fairly sad wee spoiler before I even read you any of this, and that is that in the time between this book and this book, Callum's papa has died. And so a big chunk of this book is dealing with that loss. So he's still in this beautiful place, and he's at the start of the book, he's kind of forgotten Things of Green and the others, but he does get to meet them again. But there's this loss, there's this sort of sense of sadness, even though it's an amazing place, it's the same place he's been happy as a child. It's not the same because his papa's gone. And also his friend Vicky has gone to a music school away up north, so she's gone too. So there's a lot in this about kind of changes that we all experience as we get older, and some of them are for the better and some of them not so much. But I'll read you a couple of chapters of this, and then we can have a wee blether, and then we can all go about our merry business as the evening progresses, okay? So the first chapter I want to read you from this is the second chapter of the book, and it's called Jenny. So Callum and his friends now go to the big school, like most of you go to the big school, don't you? Aren't you big boys and girls? And the nearest big school to Skerrels, I had to decide, is in Oban, which is a town on the west coast, and it's an hour's drive on the bus. So Callum and his pals have to climb on this rattly old rusty bus to go up to the school and then come back down home. But the good news is it's the October holidays now, so they've got a couple of weeks. And so here we go. The bus has just had to stop because of a mysterious old man who's standing in the middle of the road, who becomes very significant as the story goes on. But this chapter is called Jenny. And as ever, shout if you need me to explain anything, or slow down or talk more clearly or anything. Right, Jenny. As the bus edges past a group of phone engineers, Callum hears more angry honking from behind and peers back to see a car, engine revving aggressively, mount the pavement and roar past the irksome figure in the middle of the road. Clearly someone far too important to consider a detour for the sake of some old man. He and Stephen look at each other. In fact, I'm going to skip ahead a tiny wee bit. So they're driving through the town, and Callum has spotted something down the road where his papa used to live.
which is a bit troubling for him. Where can I go from? Right, the bus has paused to drop someone off, and he can see down the narrow alley where Papa used to live. He hasn't come down here for weeks. He takes different routes through the town to avoid it, though he's not entirely sure why. Now he can't help but look, and to his mingled shock and surprise, he sees a muckle great removal van parked outside. Men in overalls are carrying boxes in through Papa's front door, directed by a small round woman with dark curly hair. Before he even knows what he's doing, Callum has yelled at the bus driver not to pull away, has swiped his school bag off the back seat and is leaping off the bus. Trying not to look too frantic, he strides down the alley, turning the collar of his blazer up against the clinging har, jog-walking to the spot and arriving flustered and breathless. "Excuse me," he gasps as he arrives at the woman's side. "What's going on?" He's interrupted her in mid-flow as she explains to one of the men where she wants him to put a hideous lampshade, a thing that looks like a disco ball that's lost a fight with an octopus. The woman turns to face him. Her cheeks are flushed and she looks a bit harassed, but there's kindness in her eyes as she looks Callum up and down. "You what, darling?" she says. She has a strong accent from somewhere down south, Callum guesses. The removal man behind her looks at his watch and Callum suddenly realises he doesn't really have a plan here. He starts cleverly. "Sorry, it's just that this house was my..." The woman puts a hand on his shoulder and smiles. "Hang on a minute, love," she says. She turns to the removal man and tells him just to stick the lampshade anywhere and looks back at Callum. "Now then, young man, would you be Callum by any chance?" He nods, dumbly. "And this was your granddad's house, wasn't it?" "How did you..." She holds a finger up to quiet him, then shouts into the house. "Jenny! Jenny, come down here a minute, love." She gives Callum's shoulder a squeeze. "My daughter," she explains. "We asked if any kids lived here before we bought the place, and the estate agent told us the last owner had a grandson. Jenny was worried the old village was like a retirement home. Hard enough leaving all your mates without worrying you're going to be the only kid in the village. Know what I mean?" Sorry about the accent, by the way. Well, Callum doesn't really know what she means, but she seems nice, so his initial outrage at anyone trespassing on this sacred ground is diminishing. The woman carries on chatting away, not apparently bothered by his lack of response, and he sneaks a glance through the front door. Piles of boxes line the hall, and he can see unfaded rectangles in the wallpaper where Papa's few pictures had hung. He's starting to form a thought about this when a girl of about his own age comes thundering down the stairs and neatly slaloms the cardboard assault course to make her way out onto the street. "Yeah?" she says to her mum. She is a vision of black and purple, from her tightly laced Doc Martens to her baggy striped jumper. "Oh, hello," she says, noticing Callum. Suddenly abashed and inwardly burling at the thought that he should feel so uncomfortable here, of all places, Callum holds out a ridiculously formal hand and says, good evening. The girl gives a sharp cackle of delight, looks at her mum in disbelief. Good evening? Well, yeah, sure, good evening. She gives his hand a friendly slap. This is Callum, Jenny, says the woman. You know, the one Mr. Barnes told us about. Oh, yeah, of course, says Jenny. You coming in, Callum? Without waiting for an answer, she turns and heads back in, taking the stairs three at a time and disappearing from view. Callum, hands still outstretched and mouth open, is shuggled out of his dwam by the reappearance of the removal man. Jenny's mum, who seems to have forgotten about him already, is issuing instructions about a large box labelled CDs, photos, cooking, hats, etc. Well, why not, he thinks, and heads inside. Jenny's room used to be what Papa called the box room, a sparse square space with a small high window. She's already got a bed and a desk set up, and the room is lit by a dozen candles in different coloured jars. Other than that, it could still be a box room. Every inch of floor space is taken up with bags and boxes, crates and containers. When Callum comes in, Jenny has returned to sorting through all this junk, and she has her back to him. Have a seat, she says, without looking round. Sorry about the mess, we just got here today. Nae bother, says Callum, sitting on the desk. Jenny turns to face him. Nae bother, she laughs. I love it, okay, nae bother, Jimmy. Callum is banjaxed. Who's Jimmy? Then, realising she was making fun of his accent, he protests. Here, hang on a wee. She looks at him expectantly, eyes twinkling mischievously in the candlelight. A wee, she prompts. A wee, tiny, wee, sleek-it-minute, jing's eye. She gives a hoot of such unabashed laughter that Callum can't help joining in, slightly hurt though he is. "Cheezo," he says, "you're no shy, are you?" "I'm sorry," she says, "I'm not taking the mick, honest. Me granny was Scottish. I love it, really, but it might take a while to learn how to speak Scottish proper." Callum's about to advise her not to bother trying when she changes the subject. "Sorry about your granddad, by the way," she hops onto the bed and crosses her legs. "Really sorry. That's harsh, losing someone you're that close to." And Callum is filled with the tooth-grindingly embarrassing certainty that he's about to cry in front of this complete stranger. He can't think why. Perhaps it's being here in the house, or perhaps it's because the simple tragedy of it hasn't been so clearly summed up by any of his actual friends since it happened. Harsh is exactly what it is. He sniffs and angrily wipes his eyes. "Yeah, sorry." His voice is choked. He's angry at himself, angry at this cocky lassie in her candlelit room, just angry at everything. Jenny fills the gap in the conversation by getting back to her boxes, changing the subject again, blethering about her hometown, her parents' divorce, her plans for the decor. After a while, Callum has forgotten what he was upset about and is able to join in, and before he knows it, half an hour has passed. "Oh, hell," he yelps, leaping off the desk. "I was meant to be home ages ago. Sorry, I have to go." He swings his bag over his shoulder and heads downstairs, hearing Jenny shouting, "Off you pop then," from behind him. As he jogs through the mist for home, he is assailed by two thoughts. Firstly, how annoying this new girl in town is. And secondly, how early would be too early to call for her in the morning? So that's a new pal for Callum. And if we have time, I'd like to read you one last chapter. Have you got the attention span for it, folks? Are you okay? Your bum's not numb on the floor there yet. How are we doing for time? Yes. Right, I'll read you another chapter. So, the old man who I mentioned turns out to be a horrifying force of emptiness in the universe, all right? Oh, that's about as much as I'm going to explain to you. He's kind of the persona... Like Things of Green was like a personification of the natural world, the old man in this is like a personification of Callum's loss, the feeling of loss he has. So the old man is a character that's all about breaking connections and severing ties between people and isolating people and making them feel lost and alone in the universe. He's not a very nice character at all. And his first kind of big action in the story is he manages to lure Jenny, who you've just met, into the mountain. So we go inside the mountain in this book. And I'll read you a wee bit from... Callum's first experience inside the mountain. By the time he's back in there, he has met Things of Green, Things of Stone, Things of Blood and Things of Water again, so they're all together. And he also has met his grandmother, Elsa, who, it turns out, has been living in the mountain for a long time and is not dead as he always thought she was. So she's kind of his guide in this one. So where are we? It's a reasonable question. In the mountain does not really cut the mustard, because if he were truly inside a mountain, how would he be able to see the sky? Fair enough, the sky he can see is not the normal sky. It's the pinkly shimmering silver of salmon scales, and there's no sun in sight, but it's definitely not just the inside of a mountain. That'd be something more like the inside of a cave. Elsa moves to his side. "We are in a place where questions like that are difficult to answer," she says. "In fact, I shouldn't even say we are in a place. We are now of a place, rather than in one." "Right," says Callum. "Well, thanks for clearing that up." He looks around. They are on a beach. That much is clear. The sea sweeps away from them round a wide arcing bay, its surface undisturbed by any breath of wind. The sand is soft and pale. Colours are hard to be sure of, as if it is lit by moonlight. Off in the distance, there are shapes moving around on the water, but whether they're ships or creatures, it's impossible to tell. They make Callum slightly nervous, so he turns away to look at the land. Back home, with Things of Green's influence, every square inch of the landscape of Skerrels feels like an old friend, familiar and welcoming, and Callum has the same sense here that the land is a breathing, feeling thing, but that sense has been derailed, shunted off kilter. It is at once much more powerful and much less understandable. He feels the way he might if his pals all started talking to him in Swahili very, very loudly. There is meaning, important meaning, but it's beyond his grasp. If feels like potential, like the possibility of things, rather than the things themselves. Wait a minute, says Callum. I thought you said this was Skerrels somehow, but there's nothing here even a wee bit like Skerrels. Visually, it is bare and rocky and sloping up to a low, misty pinnacle in the distance. This is a wasteland, he says, which brings things of stone uncomfortably close, a looming presence at his left side. It forms itself out of sand and pebbles and a low, rumbling anger.
Unmoulded clay, Callum Maxwell, it growls. This is the mountain at the end and ready to begin again.
We are outside of time, says Elsa. This is the land of the forgotten. It does not travel by seconds and minutes, but from here you can get to almost anywhere. Anywhen, corrects Things of Green. You will always be here. Callum's head is beginning to hurt. Look, he says, I came here to find Jenny. Can we just get started?
Indeed, come four fell voices at once, and all of a sudden, Callum is pitched from his feet as the ground beneath him begins to rumble and shake. The air thickens with electricity, the sky darkens, and the distant pinnacle starts to rock and tumble. A jagged crack opens in its side, wider, wider, stretching out across the land like a lightning bolt. From within the crack, Callum sees an ominous red glow and the ground beneath him grows hot to the touch.
What's going on? He yells, teeth chattering from the roiling clanjamfrey beneath him. He tries to stand but cowps over again as the ground bulges and splits and great fiery pits appear around him. Things of stone has grown enormous, exultant, while the others flit and dash about like frightened spugs. Beginning, round we go again, they cry, their manic glee infecting Callum with a deep and crackling terror. Acrid smoke is now billowing from the cracks, and above him he sees gouts of molten lava oozing hungrily from the split and sundered landscape. Gobs of it burst and fizz from the pits around him, and everything is bathed in the hellish red light as the whole unsettled landscape boils over. Help! Shrieks Callum, unable to stand and certain he's about to be swallowed by an advancing surge of lava. Strong hands grasp his shoulders and lift him to his feet, and instantly he's surrounded by a bubble of clear, cool air. He turns to see Elsa, who is surveying the scene with a calm detachment.
Whisht, dear heart, she says. You wanted to get started, and so we are. This is the mountain's beginning. Born in a storm of fire and destruction, pushed skyward by an unquiet earth. Impressive, is it not?
All around them is a raging tumult, but Elsa speaks as calmly as if she were telling a soothing bedtime story.
You mean the mountain is a volcano?
Callum is still yelling, even though it's quiet in the bubble, and Elsa winces at the unnecessary volume.
Oh, sorry, he mumbles,
then realises he's got nothing to be sorry about. After all, he didn't ask the planet to explode beneath him. But before he can express this, Elsa speaks again.
At the beginning, it is, she says. At the end, it is the beach you stood upon a moment ago, worn to sand by eons of wind and rain and ice. It is, at the same time, the mountain that stands still and eternal behind your Skerrels. It is every one of those things, Callum.
The eruption is reaching its peak. Plumes of smoke and dust and ash spewing into the atmosphere in a glowering column several miles high. The column takes the form of a raging giant, and Callum speechlessly realises it is Things of Stone, unleashed and unstoppable, a primordial entity of ground-splitting power. It roars and cackles, flinging sizzling boulders down like asteroids crashing into the sea, reshaping the world. The tumult is terrifying, close, chaotic, and Callum wants to cover his eyes. Where the burning rubble hits the sea, steam shrieks and hisses and roils and glories, things of water, ecstatic and fizzing. There is the sense that these two entities are fighting, a joyful, cacophonous, catastrophic battle that engulfs sky and sea and sensation. Things of blood and things of green are nowhere to be seen. The bubble rises through the raging tumult until Callum, looking down on the scene, sees that everything has shifted. The air is cleared and the mountain is still and cool and much, much higher than Callum knows it from his world. That such a thing could rise from the ground seems impossible.
It's like Mount Everest, he gasps.
From here, at the peak, the landscape below them is all but invisible, lost in hazy clouds that hug the foothills.
but Callum thinks he can make out the coastline in a shape that could almost be MacArthur's Island. The view is breathtaking but vertiginous, and he decides not to think too closely about just what, if anything, is holding him up here. Snow begins to swirl and drift around them, small flakes at first, then fat, fluffy clumps, falling and piling and falling and piling, and the mountain's lofty summit is soon a dazzle of blinding white. Suddenly they are falling with the snow, the mighty peak piercing upwards at them as they tumble. Callum opens his mouth in a silent scream, the whistling air around them robbing him of breath. They batter into the jagged summit, Callum certain of destruction and astonished to find he is unhurt, while Elsa smiles placidly as someone who has seen this all before. They are sliding down the mountain now, skating past snow-filled precipices, a vapour trail of sparkling snowflakes flying up behind them. As they slide, the snow becomes ice, becomes a glacier, begins to move along with them, shearing off city-sized chunks of mountain as it flows. Eons are passing in the blink of an eye, and Callum, who hasn't blinked for 10 minutes or more, turns to see the lofty peak of moments before gently settle as if the land is letting out a long, cool sigh. They thunder on, leaving the snowfields and hurtling through burgeoning green, steamy jungles of moss-laden trees, outlandish creatures scattering at their passing. And there are things of green and things of blood, flying alongside them outside the bubble, laughing, twirling, merging and splitting and growing and shrinking and flashing 1,000 forms a second. At times it seems they are one, then it seems they are splitting, strange forms spinning off them like eddies in a whirlpool, only to come to nothing in their wake. Callum shrieks in terrified excitement as their bubble flies through the legs of a dinosaur, some giant sauropod grazing on the trees. It lifts its monstrous neck to bellow at their passing and is gone.
I think I want to go home, Callum gasps through chattering teeth.
And no sooner have the words left his mouth than they are still. He stands, panting, on sun-warmed grass that has been grazed flat by sheep and deer and rabbits. The sudden stillness makes his ears ring, and he feels the way you do when you wake from a dream of falling. He turns to see the mountain, just as he knows it, but with more trees around its lower slopes. Over there is the Monument Hill, though no monument stands atop it, and there, down there, is the crooked notch in the coast that is the harbour in Callum's Skerrels. Here, or perhaps now, it shows no signs of development, no walls, no boats. It's wild stone lapped by an untroubled sea. There is a scattering of crude huts just below them, little more than tents made of wooden poles and animal skins. Some have smoke rising from their peaks, and a low mumble of voices reaches them through the warm, still air. Callum pats himself down. He's undamaged. He slows his breathing from the mortal terror of a few moments before and shuffles about a bit to reassure himself that the law of gravity is behaving more normally now. Things of Green and the others have gone for the time being, but Elsa stands by him, waiting patiently. Right, he says, and begins to formulate a clever thought about what this all means when a sharp dig in the ribs makes him yelp. Oi! He hollers, ready to vent his towering confusion on whatever baffling and mischievous sprite thought that was a funny thing to do. It's Jenny. Her eyes, wide with giggly panic, are darting from him to Elsa to the oddly tranquil proto-skerrels around them. Anyone want to tell me what the bloody hell is going on? She asks. And that's the end of that chapter. Right. That's about as much as I can read you without spoiling it completely, so hopefully some of you will feel the urge to read it yourselves. But if you've got any questions at all about it, or about writing in general, or about anything that's crossing your mind, then do please feel free to fire away. Yes. Oh, that's a very good question. Let's see. Not really. I was really lucky, actually, because I didn't get asked to. Lots of writers, when they finish a book and send it into a publisher, the publisher writes back and says, well, you know, I quite like the main character and I quite like the title, but could you change everything else, please? I actually know one writer who was writing a historical novel, so it was set in, I think, Victorian Edinburgh. It was a children's novel.
And she finished the thing, sent it off to a big publisher, and they said, yes, this is great, we really like it, just change this, this, and this. And so she did that, changed that, sent it back, said, oh, yep, no, it's still good, but do you mind just changing a couple of... In fact, do you mind... We don't really like the fact that it's a historical novel. Could you just set it in the present day, please? So the whole point of the book was just thrown out the window, and I didn't have any of that with mine, because I've got a wee independent publisher who are very understanding. So no huge changes, really. But lots of times if you start a story, you do have to go back and do that great big sweeping editing, which I think must be slightly soul-destroying. But no, it's a really good question. No, it was more or less the story I wanted to tell. Yes, Hazel.
I dare say each book is different, but how long does it take from the idea to the hard copy of the book?
That's an excellent question. And the honest answer, from idea, it could be... decades. So I'm still carrying around ideas of stories I had when I was tiny wee, or things I've seen that I think might be nice in a story. And I really recommend that you don't discard an idea just because you've had it and it's not come in handy straight away. Keep it. It's money in the bank. It's treasure. Your experiences and your thoughts and your ideas are all there for you to use when you want. But from the point of actually sitting down and deciding, no, I am going to write this, it is going to be a book, I think the first one was about 6 months. I was teaching full-time at the time as well, though, so I was not just sitting writing. And then that one took a lot longer because it was during lockdown, and lockdown was just, as you will remember, a very weird time where it was very hard to concentrate on anything terribly much. But I got there in the end. So it really varies. And I've still got stories and ideas that I've been working on for ages, and sometimes they just pop out completely formed. So it can be anything, Hazel. That's a good question, though. Yes. That's a really good question too. Probably, I mean, there's the influences that you know, so there's the things that you read and think, I might pinch that, but then there's also the stuff that you maybe have forgotten, and actually, it's Anne, isn't it? Sorry. What's your name again, sorry, at the back? Yes, it is. Yes, you're mentioning a writer called George MacDonald, who's a Scottish kind of fairy tale and fantasy writer from the late 19th century, ages ago, and my dad read me those stories when I was wee, and they were still kind of lurking about in the back of my head. But I didn't deliberately try and pinch any ideas. But when my dad read the book, he said, this is very like George MacDonald that I read you when you were wee. So some of the influences are kind of a long term. But in terms of actually just not really. I don't really try and be like anybody else if I can help it. We are all like each other in lots of different ways, whether we like it or not. But when you're making your own stuff, when you're making your own, or when I'm making my own thing, if it's a song or a story or whatever, I really wouldn't think I'd done a good job if someone could just straight away say, oh, I know where you got that idea. You got that idea from this book or from that writer. So hopefully fairly original. And a few folk did say that they were quite original, which was nice. Is that a good answer? Cool. Yes.
Do you think you'll be doing another, like a third book, or will this just carry on or not?
That is a really good question. I know what the third would be if it existed, but I don't mind if it never exists. So I tried to, in this one, because I didn't really want to write, I think there's plenty of sequels in the world already, you know, you can't make one film without having it turn it into a massive, big, long series of films these days, and I quite like a standalone story. But this one did pop up, and at the end of this, I try and sort of more or less remove the option of writing another book for myself. So the person who's telling the story, the narrator, the narrative voice, says goodbye at the end of this story. Cheerio, that's it, I'm done. So I shouldn't write another one, but I might do it at some point. But I will still write songs and poems and wee stories and things like that, but writing a big long book is not that these are that long, but writing a whole novel is quite time consuming. Yes, Hazel.
Do you find that the types and genres of books that you read sort of influence the ideas and the things that you write?
That's a really good question too. That's quite like what you were asking too, isn't it? Yeah. The kind of, I mean, is anyone in here interested in writing their own stories? I know some of you do write your own stories. Some of you are all, because I've read some of them a long time ago, but does anyone write for pleasure in here or make up tales for pleasure? You do, that's brilliant. Yeah, a wee bit. Or think that you might do it at some point in the future. Yes. Slapped by a Baby, for example, Noah, your epic series that is underway right now. That's great. If you read advice on how to do it, the advice from the industry is always read as many books as you possibly can. Read everything that's out there. And that is good advice because you'll get an idea of what sells quite well and what's popular. But you then have the freedom to decide, do I want to write something just because I think it's going to be popular, or do I want to stick with my original idea, whatever that might have been? And there's not really a right or wrong answer to which one you choose. Whichever one you're moved to do, I sort of went with the second one. I thought, well, I don't actually need to be successful because I've already got a perfectly good job, so I can indulge myself and just write the story I want to write. And I'm much happier that I did that than I would have been if I had rewritten it to make it more commercial or taken the Scots words out, as some folks suggest I should do, and that kind of thing. So you can't help but be influenced by what you've read, but try to be as original as you can at the same time, I would suggest. You'll have noticed I give long, wordy answers to questions. A simple yes or no would be fine. Yes?
I think you can answer this quite quickly.
Oh, yeah. He's mentioned briefly, I think. Doesn't have a starring role like that one again, unfortunately. In fact, that exact instant is mentioned. Callum mentions to Jenny that the first time they met Things of Blood, he made a dog stand up and talk, and his owner didn't even notice. So it is referenced again, yes. Maybe he could get his own spin-off story, couldn't he? He's a terribly polite little dog, isn't he? A very clear idea about what the wee walking dog would be like, which is funny. It's great. Yes. Well, the first one was, I had the idea of the idea of old spirits that have been there for forever, but that we've kind of lost touch with. I probably had that when I first started going hiking in the Highlands as about a 12-year-old. I just like the notion that when you're out walking, you have your surface experience, which is, oh, it's a lovely day, or oh, it's pouring with rain, or oh, my legs are tired. But there are other levels of experience of a landscape that I like to imagine, and it's fine if it's just imagination. There are folk who believe in them really profoundly. Like, there's religions based on thinking that trees have spirits, or that animals have spirits and things. And, you know, I'm sure those are very rewarding religions too, and I'm not going to say that that's true or not, because I don't think that's important. But if you have a strong feeling of a living landscape, then the idea of turning that living landscape into characters takes about 30 years to develop, it seems, in my head anyway, it did. So that was an old idea, but the friends themselves are kind of my pals from when I was wee. It's a bit autobiographical in some ways, but the idea of the mountain moving and that was, I couldn't tell you exactly how long it was. It was lingering for a long time before I decided to use it. Hey, folks, I sense that people are ready to stop sitting on the floor quite soon. So unless there's any other questions, folks, we can call that an evening. I'm really, really lovely to see you all. Thank you for coming. And I hope you've enjoyed the readings. And the books are both in the library, and you can borrow them from the library. I have some to sell if anybody had wanted to buy one, but I didn't think you'd be coming in here with piles of money, so that's fine. So that's that. Thank you very much indeed, folks. Pleasure reading to you today.